Before we begin, I would just like our record to show that we were in receipt of a motion to recuse the members of the division, and that we had considered that motion and we had denied it this morning. Okay?
Correct.
Okay. You may proceed with our argument.
I had to check out all the new equipment.
There's a lot of it in this building.
My name is Michael Poindexter. I am registration number 12591, and I represent the appellants in this matter, which include both myself and my client, Michael Malin, and my co-counsel, Michael Kleinman. Hey, please the court. We're here on a matter of attorney's fees awarded under CRS 1317-102 after the prosecution of claims by us on behalf of Michael Malin against the defendants Stephen Naples, Heidi Naples, Naples Franchising Systems, Inc., and the Naples Group, Inc. The underlying case is over. It was lost at trial. It was lost on appeal. But in a larger sense here, it's not over. Mike Malin, in the underlying case, invested $170,000 with Steve and Heidi Naples, who own the Heidi's Brooklyn Deli chain of restaurants, among other businesses, and he lost it all in 2 years, while the Naples flourished. The question presented here, the limited question, is not whether Malin's claim should have won or not, but whether the underlying claim that sought to apply the alter ego doctrine and hold Heidi Naples, Naples Franchising Systems, and the Naples Group, Inc. liable for the damages caused by Stephen Naples, whether those claims were so devoid of facts and were so far outside of the parameters of the law, that they were egregious, that they were frivolous, that they were groundless. Because that's what the trial court said.
Hey, as I understand it, counsel, I may be wrong here, but the trial court said the claim, the alter ego piercing the corporate veil claim against Heidi was frivolous because there was no law that would support that theory of the business entity, right, or applying business entity liability to a individual. But with respect to the other, the corporate defendants, I thought the trial court's ruling was, I can't see any evidence. It's more groundless than frivolous.
Well, you're partially correct. Heidi Naples was, the court found, both frivolous and groundless. The court said, with respect to Heidi Naples, there were no facts presented, and I'm quoting from his order dated December 12th at page 8. There were no facts presented and no legal theory advanced under which Heidi Naples could be liable. Okay. And there was not any evidence upon which the two business entities could be similarly liable. All right. The record is our salvation in this case, because the record shows otherwise. There was a legal theory that the trial judge himself endorsed 4 months before trial when he denied a 12b-5 motion to dismiss on the grounds that failed to state a claim. He specifically said in the order from that ruling, the plaintiffs have stated a prima facie case based on the allegations in the complaint. So to me, as a lawyer, that means your legal theory is okay. Now you've got to back up what you stated in the complaint.
Is that ruling binding on us in any way in terms of whether it's legally correct?
I don't think so. I don't. But we're not really here to determine whether that legal theory should have prevailed at trial on the evidence. We're here to determine if I was so far out of line that I was egregious and presented no rational argument.
So you're saying that the failure to dismiss the claim at that early stage, though it may have been error itself, insulates a later claim of frivolousness of that?
What I'm asking the court to consider, because you've got to consider this against the backdrop of the attorney's fees award cases that say it's designed to deter egregious conduct. You know, against that backdrop, you've got to ask yourself, step in my shoes, 4 months before trial, somebody says this legal theory is no good, and the trial court says, oh yes it is, and I'm not going to dismiss the claim pending trial. What am I supposed to do? Back away and say, no judge, you're wrong, I'm going to fold my tents on that claim? No. We felt we had the imprimatur of the trial court to go forward.
Yes, but if the trial court was indeed incorrect in its ruling,
right.
12B,
right.
Are you then, isn't it true that you're not insulated by that ruling from...
I'm insulated not from being wrong, but I'm insulated from being egregious. That's the reason we're here today.
Is there case law? Do you have case law that would support that?
Say again, please.
Do you have case law that would support that?
That would support what?
The proposition you just announced, that you're insulated from any liability for attorney's fees because the trial court declined to dismiss your claim against Ms. Naples under 12b-5.
I don't think there is a case law that says that, and I'm not arguing any concept of insulation. This is not a magic barrier or shield that I'm insulated.
You're saying we should consider.
I'm just saying you should consider.
Okay.
Consider what a trial lawyer is supposed to do 4 months before trial when the trial judge agrees with his theory and says go forward with your claim. So there was also...
He decided the motion to dismiss 4 months before trial.
Correct.
How long was that between the time the complaint was filed?
Oh, the complaint was filed 2 years earlier.
Okay.
The case had been continued for trial twice. The claims had been... We had a moving target here.
So you relied on the trial court's ruling for 4 months. Before that, you obviously were not relying on the trial court's ruling. Right?
Well, we filed an amended complaint where we restated that count. The trial court had dismissed certain claims. We had amended the complaint. But from that point forward, based on the amended complaint we filed, we felt we had a case, at least on that claim. The other claims aren't at issue. The trial court made no finding that those were egregious or those were frivolous or groundless. So we had a case that was going to trial. The question is, did it include this claim? And 4 months prior to trial, the judge said yes.
That may address the frivolousness. What about the groundlessness?
Again, the record is our salvation. If you look at my statement of facts in the opening brief, I cite page and line to the record where the testimony of Heidi Naples came in and she admitted moving money around among 20-something Naples entities. It reminds me a lot of the Lapeep case, and there's some language in Lapeep that is similar. It says it's a concerted effort to hide the ball, to play a show game. And there were admissions by Heidi Naples that I quoted in the statement of facts where she admitted we commingled funds on a daily basis. That's a quote from her testimony. As the court knows, commingling is one of the factors to consider.
Counsel, is it your theory that under your piercing the veil claim that Ms. Naples and the corporate defendants are jointly and severally liable with Mr. Naples? Or, and I understand the piercing the veil, it's only if Mr. Naples is unable to satisfy judgment that they would become.
Yeah, this, you know, you can bring a piercing the veil claim under Colorado law, pardon me. (Clears throat) either after trial during the garnishment or collection proceedings, as the Lapeet case did, or you can bring it before trial if you believe you can prove it then. And we elected to bring it.
And is there evidence in the record that Mr. Naples was unable to respond to a judgment?
No. No.
Isn't that a big problem for him?
No. No.
That's an essential element, isn't it?
No, it's not an essential element. It's
isn't that, I mean, there's three prongs, right, to the analysis. One is the issue that you push, which is the intercompany transactions. But there's also this equitable issue and whether or not
to defeat a rightful point.
Right, right. And that only becomes relevant if the, in this case, the reverse, you're doing a reverse piercing. So if the if Mr. Naples is insolvent or is unable to respond to a judgment.
Well, the undisputed facts at trial were that the money out of these three restaurants that Mr. Malin's money went into originally and was taken out of, wrongfully we allege, was gone. There was nothing there. And there was clear, undisputed testimony by Heidi Naples that she transferred money around anytime she felt like it.
But my question is, you sued Mr. Naples for the fraud and the inducement claim, and that's the only one who went to trial.
That is, the only, after the rest of our claims?
I shouldn't say it was the only one who went to trial. That was the only one that survived the motion at halftime. So, the question then isn't whether Mr. Naples is able to respond to a judgment, whether Mr. Naples was hiding assets in these two corporations?
I don't think that was argued at the trial court level. It was certainly not part of the court's opinion.
But if those are elements, wouldn't that be on your side to produce that evidence?
You know, Your Honor, it's a good question. And under the facts of the case, I frankly don't remember what Steve Naples' deposition testimony was about his personal assets. All I know is they were not giving the money back to Mike Malin, and they moved whatever money they had around wherever they chose to move it without any accounting for it at the time, without any of the normal corporate procedures that you'd expect to be followed. And I said before, we were aiming at a moving target. Well, that money was the moving target. It was, on a day-to-day basis, commingled and gone. So, to answer your question, I don't know. It wasn't addressed below, and we didn't brief it in this case.
Well, let me ask you another question, counsel. Didn't the trial court say, gee, you know, when we're trying to look at this analysis, the first prong of the alter ego piercing and veil test, there's six or seven factors. I didn't get evidence of this factor. I didn't get evidence of this factor. I didn't get evidence of this factor.
Right.
Right now, you've indicated there was evidence of commingling funds.
Yes.
What about those other factors?
Well, if you'll let me pull out the statement of facts, because if the Lapeet case has a nice sentence in it, it says the court may consider these factors, but it may consider others as well. It doesn't say any of these factors are exclusive or necessary or anything else. This is a court in equity that is trying to look at the facts and determine whether somebody is abusing the system here. The funds invested by Malin in the three restaurants were placed in general operating funds. They were commingled on a daily basis with all other monies from the other Naples businesses, and there were more than 20 of them, although there are only two that were named defendants here. The Naples admitted moving money around to keep everything going and avoid the businesses closing. I took money to pay the bills on American Express for all the stores on one or two bills from wherever I had cash. So that's the money. There were no financial statements prepared. That is her testimony. There were no corporate tax returns prepared until after this case was 2 years old. there was a contract signed by the Naples Group, Inc., one-party dependent, to repay a $275,000 loan, but everybody understood that the entity paying it back was Lucille's, which was one of Mike Malin's restaurants that he invested in. $10,000 was transferred to the Naples Group from the Conifer Sushi High within the first month of Malin's investment, and there was no explanation, there's no legal affiliation, it was just one of their businesses. None of these loans, and they call them intercompany transfers, that's what Heidi Naples called them, were accompanied by promissory notes, terms of repayment, interest. Instead, the monies were just used as necessary. Now, the exhibits, not just Heidi Naples' testimony, we had canceled checks showing thousands of dollars transferred to Heidi Naples individually, to the Naples Group, Inc., to Naples Franchising Systems, Inc. And finally,
Council,
yes,
I believe you're out of time, sir.
You know, I am.
Thank you for your argument.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Mark Ruskin. My registration number is 7732. I'm here today with an associate from our office, Mr. Charles Fuller, whose registration number is 43923, and we are here representing the appellees in this matter, Your Honor. First of all, as stated by the appellant in its opening brief, the trial court's legal analysis is not subject to appeal. What we are here today is for an examination as to whether or not there was an abuse of discretion by the trial court in entering its order for assessment of attorney's fees with respect to plaintiff's fourth claim for relief. And through the course of the trial, the trial court heard the evidence and lack thereof and entered an order dismissing the fourth claim for relief.
Well, you know, with respect to abuse of discretion, sometimes you can abuse your discretion by an erroneous application of the law. Sometimes you can abuse your discretion by making decisions without, you know, supporting a record. Let me ask you, when the issue is kind of like whether there's a rational argument to support a claim, isn't that de novo review? Isn't that subject to de novo review by this court? Whether a rational argument can or was made in support of a claim?
That is not before the court, Your Honor.
Well, if something is claimed to have been frivolous, and the appellant says it wasn't frivolous because the test is, was can a rational argument be made, I would think that would be before the court.
Well, it may have been able to be presented to the court, Your Honor, but specifically in the appellant's opening brief at page 21, it states the legal analysis the trial court used in considering its decision to award attorney's fees against the plaintiff and his attorneys is not in itself being challenged on this appeal. If that was the case, Your Honor, we would have been able to properly respond to that argument and assert the legal arguments to contradict that. We weren't given that opportunity because that issue has not been presented for appeal.
I thought you were given that opportunity because I thought you responded by saying there is no such thing as law that applies to an individual, the alter ego and piercing the corporate veil theory, nor is there any reason for that. So I think you may have responded to the lack of a rational argument for that. My question is, what about the issue about the trial court's perhaps erroneous finding that there had been a claim stated? Does that not lead opposing counsel to believe that it's not frivolous to go excuse me, to go forward with that claim?
Even if that claim was not frivolous, the court found specifically that it was groundless.
And that's true.
And that's where the abuse of discretion comes into play.
So you're saying there was no evidence presented in support of the theory that Heidi Naples herself was involved in the shell game or was part of a shell game as well?
Well, let's step back a second and not accept the contention or the characterization by Mr. Poindexter that it was a shell game.
Well, I'll tell you what, I agree with you. We shouldn't have to accept that characterization. But again, when you're determining whether something is groundless, it's not necessarily a question of, well, I presented evidence, you presented evidence, I accepted your evidence, so therefore the other side must be groundless, is it?
Well, let's remember what was presented at trial and what was dismissed pursuant for a motion for judgment on the pleadings. At the time the trial commenced, there was one claim in a substantive matter, and that was fraud in the inducement against Stephen Naples. Pursuant to the court's entry of an order granting our motion for judgment on the pleadings, the court ruled that after Mr. Malin purchased his interest in the three limited liability companies, he no longer had any interest in those funds. So, with all due respect, the discussion about the movement of those funds is a distraction to the claim of fraud in the inducement with respect to Stephen Naples, and then the reverse corporate piercing or alter ego claim as to the corporate defendants and Heidi Naples. The funds that were addressed by Mr. Poindexter during his presentation and in his brief are irrelevant because those funds belong to the limited liability companies. What we do have to do is look at the record and the absence of evidence with respect to the criteria for a reverse corporate piercing.
Is a claim groundless if, say there are four elements to the claim, and for two of them there is actually no evidence, for two of them there is some evidence, can that claim be groundless?
I believe that the case law said, in terms of satisfying the requirements of Phillips,
yes,
the Supreme Court, and I believe other court cases with corporate piercing, go through an analysis that not all of the criteria need to be satisfied.
Well, but I'm not focusing on how many criteria are satisfied, but for example, if you have a breach of contract claim, it may be undisputed that there's a contract, which is an essential element of a breach of contract claim, but there may be a dispute as to whether or not there was a breach. And let's say that there's no evidence to support the fact that there's a breach. Even though there's evidence to support the existence of a contract, does that mean that the claim is groundless?
I don't know if that issue has been determined. I know that
in this case, he has some evidence to support that there were intercompany transfers. And is that enough to establish that it's not groundless, or is the fact that there was a lack of standing and the whole inquiry?
Well, the mere fact that there were intercompany transfers has to be connected back to Stephen Naples. And that there was no evidence as to that. No.
Well, so my question is, does that fact, the fact that there's a lack of standing, or that they can't be traced back to Mr. Naples, you want to say that? My question is, does the claim become groundless, even though there are these intercompany transfers, because they're not linked to Stephen Naples or because there's a lack of standing?
I believe both. And let me give you my view on it. This case, or this particular claim, was tried as if the conversion and civil theft claims were still alive, and they weren't. So all of these transfers had really nothing to do with trying to attach vicarious liability, so to speak, of Heidi Naples and the two corporate defendants to Stephen Naples. There were no corporate records presented. Mr. Naples' individual financial records were not presented. The court was very careful when it reviewed the criteria of the Phillips case in analyzing what was presented to him. And the mere fact that checks were presented without any type of connection back to Mr. Naples, in and of itself, is by definition part of the reason the court found that the reverse corporate piercing claim was both frivolous and groundless as to Heidi Naples and groundless as to the corporate defendants. You've heard, there's been, again, I think, an effort to distract the attention of both the trial court and this panel from what was really the burden to prove up these claims. And the fourth claim for relief is corporate piercing slash alter ego. And there was no evidence presented that the trial court found that satisfied the criteria for a loosely pled, if not vague and somewhat ambiguous claim. And again, I go back to what the standard is for this panel, and that is an abuse of discretion. And with all due respect to what Mr. Poindexter has tried to suggest, there has not been any proof in the opening brief or in the reply brief that comes close to showing that there was an abuse of discretion by the trial court. And that's where, you know, that's a standard that this court is to apply. So in conclusion, we think that we're hearing the same arguments. We heard the same arguments at the time the court considered the motion for directed verdict. We heard the same arguments at the time the response to the motion for attorney's fees was considered by the court, and we're hearing the same arguments today. And nothing has changed. And for those reasons, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the order assessing attorney's fees, and further that this panel award the appellees their attorney's fees to defend against this appeal.
I have another question for you, if I
please.
May. You were awarded approximately, I think, $4,000 for your post-trial legal fees?
I was.
My understanding is that the defendant sought $120,000 in legal fees, claiming that all four claims were frivolous. The court determined that only one of the The court determined that only one of the claims, the piercing the corporate veil slash alter ego claim, was frivolous, and ended up awarding only $26,000 in attorney's fees. Does that establish that the plaintiff's defense of that motion was frivolous or groundless, entitling you to attorney's fees? So it was $4,000 in attorney's fees?
Let me correct one part of your assumption.
And then would you answer the question, but please
sure.
Correct.
We did not ask for attorney's fees with respect to the claims concerning the conversion or civil theft that were dismissed under the motion for judgment on the pleadings.
Okay. So it was just the fraud inducement and the piercing claim.
Right, and responding to what we believe was to be a frivolous and groundless motion for summary judgment. But the...
That's right, yes.
Okay.
So there were three things.
Correct. And
and you recovered on one.
We recovered on what?
And you recovered a small fraction of the total amount you received.
The judge did a very careful analysis and apportioned in a manner consistent with what he viewed to be an appropriate award.
So is the, my question for you though, which you promised to answer, is whether or not that is a frivolous motion when they prevailed on a substantial part of it?
I believe that to the extent that we prevailed on the one claim, the court took that into account and awarded the attorney's fees appropriately.
On the $4,000, is that how much you requested?
No.
Okay, how much had you requested in that fees on fees?
I believe it was in the nature of, $16,000, Your Honor.
Okay. And the trial court appears to have apportioned the $4,000 as it would have related to the alter ego piercing the corporate veil?
Yes.
Yeah, and the trial court has authority to do that?
I believe it does.
Did you cite the same authority suggesting it does?
Well, I think it has the authority to address the award of attorney's fees with respect to the claim, just as it did in the motion in chief, and with respect to the prosecution of that claim, in face of the defense that was the same set of facts and the law that was trying to resist it, and the court found otherwise, that we were entitled to award of attorney's fees with respect to that portion of the motion, which dealt with the relief that was actually granted.
Is it possible to have a frivolous claim and present a non-frivolous defense to a request for attorney fees with respect to that claim?
In the abstract, the answer would be yes, but in this case, the answer would be no, because there was nothing new or different presented at any stage of these proceedings by the appellant.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both counsel for their arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both.